Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast.
Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know?
My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Today, we're going to answer that most contentious of Beatle questions. Who was the fifth Beatle? And we're going to answer it conclusively, once and for all. No, we're not really. This is one of these conversations that never ends. We're going to look into the question in detail, and you can maybe make up your mind for yourself. But it's a difficult one to answer, isn't it, Stephen? Who was the true fifth Beatle?
It is. I mean, everyone sort of instinctively has a name that pops into their head. Your name won't be the same as my name. And once you start to delve into it, there are dozens of candidates.
Yes. And so what we've kind of been thinking about is that, you know, maybe in the future we need to look at, you know, sixth, seventh and eighth Beatles. There's a whole ecosystem of people around the Beatles who each are worthy of discussion and looking at their role in the story. But today we're going to look at, in particular, people who played with the Beatles as fifth Beatles. And maybe towards the end, we're going to look at the Brian Epstein, George Martin axis of things as well. But this notion of a fifth Beatle, at the start, you know, by the end of 63, I think it's Tony Barrow and with the Beatles who comes up with Fabulous Foursome, the Fab Four, this notion of that there's four of them. But then I think the fifth Beatle term comes when they get to the US, and it's Murray the K who's often labeled with coining the phrase.
Yes, George Harrison dubbed Murray the K, who was a New York disc jockey, as being the fifth Beatle. Murray the K was very involved in promoting them, and I suppose it was a little sort of accolade, but Murray the K picked that up and ran with it, and that I think just became his permanent calling card. So he is the fifth.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's in his Wikipedia page. It's what people think about when they think, like, the only reason we're discussing Murray the K today is that somehow he managed to get himself called the fifth Beatle. But we're going to
That's the end of the episode.
Well, no, we are going to state for the record the fifth Beatle is definitely not Murray the K. And in our ranking of which Beatle he was, maybe he's in the 70s. I don't know. He's 70.
He's definitely in the top 100.
It's not Murray the K. So perhaps what we might look at first is people who could genuinely say that they were Beatle number five. They were the fifth Beatle. And the original fifth Beatle was when they were a five piece. And the first person we should look at is Stuart Sutcliffe.
Yeah. So, I mean, people tend to forget that there was a period where there were five Beatles.
Yeah.
So are we coming to the end of the episode again?
No, this is not how this works.
Okay. So, you know, Sutcliffe is drafted into the band, not much of a bass player. That's a whole other story, perhaps, but how he gets to be in the band and his role and the sort of personality issues there and the dynamic between him and the rest of the band. But he is there on stage in Hamburg playing the bass, a fairly rudimentary bass.
Yeah. Probably
because no one else wants to do that job.
And it's interesting because the legend is that, you know, as you say, he was in art school with Lennon. He was an artist. He got paid a substantial sum of money for one of his works. And he's convinced by the Beatles, I think it's £75, to spend that on a bass. And he's the bass player in a five-man Beatles. So he is the fifth Beatle, or he's one of the five Beatles, when Pete Best is still the drummer. And, you know, what's interesting in this story is the Beatles are kind of bringing him in, not because of his musical skills, which is interesting, because you could say that John brings in Paul and John brings in George because of pure musical skills. But this is a style decision, that Stuart Sutcliffe was the first stylistic decision that the Beatles made as a band.
I think so. And it's hugely influential. It's interesting to speculate how much they appreciated that at the time.
Yeah.
You know, when he first joins the band, he's dressing the same. He's dressed in leathers. He's got the sunglasses. He's got the hair swept back. He's certainly the coolest person on that stage.
Yeah.
He exudes a certain art school cool. But yes, he becomes increasingly important in the image of the band.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. He's the first and arguably the only person who's ever in the band other than on merit. He's there because he is part of Lennon's group, and there is a dynamic. There is a very strong friendship.
Yes.
Between
well, that's just it. Two. Friendship is true. You know, like you know, a lot of people talk about you know when the Beatles hit big in '64, the dynamic was that they seemed to be friends with each other, that they were a unit. And so this was having Stuart Sutcliffe in the band was this notion of, well, actually, we need to be friends or we need to be a unit, as I said, plus this aspect of style. And it kind of brings the notion of the Beatles as a group. He has a really important role in kind of codifying what that means, that it's that there's an essence beyond just the musicianship itself.
I think so. I think that's exactly it. And you know, he and Lennon, that there's books, episodes to be done, books to be written just on that relationship.
Yeah.
So how close a relationship must they have had that Lennon was prepared to say, you can come and be in this gang, you have to be part of this gang, you can't play, you don't have any musical talent. It sometimes you see it written about as if it was a purely mercenary decision. You know, he had the money, he could afford to buy the, you know, don't spend it on a holiday, don't spend it on art materials, spend it on a bass, because that will help the band out. But that can't be the only reason. It can't be as mercenary as that.
Yeah, there is this kind of mercenary aspect. But, you know, if you change the how you look at it and you say the band needs him, like if Lennon says, no, this band needs Stuart in it. And then you kind of, with the grand scope of things, you can say, yes, it was really important that he was in the band. And he did become the bridge between, you know, what they got out of the German, the artistic side of the German experience, you know, their exposure to Astrid and Co. And, you know, which led to the photographs and the haircuts and all that kind of stuff, that you could argue that maybe that might not have happened or might not have happened to the way that it did if Stuart hadn't been in the band at that time for that time.
Yes, there's a certain aesthetic that he brings.
Yeah.
And that's amplified whenever he and Astrid get together in Hamburg. And, you know, you look at the photographs that she took at the time. And the camera, her camera, loves the band.
Yeah.
But particularly loves Stuart.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is just this aesthetic that he brings. And again, he's fundamental in that shift away from the leather clad teddy boy, sort of greased up hair rocker image, and moving them to the combed down hair, the mop top, that sort of X-y, that existential, look that he was really the conduit for that, I suppose. So musically, you know, he's not contributing a lot musically. There's some speculation as to that there is no recording, I think.
Yes.
So I'm sure someone will correct me on that. But there's no recording of Stuart singing or playing and he with the band. You know, there are some of the demo tapes and the early rehearsals in you know, Paul McCartney's father's house, that you can hear a voice speaking, but I think I'm right in saying there's no recording of Stuart's voice anywhere. So he's sort of this spectral presence.
Yeah.
Hugely important early on.
Yes.
And if you think about it, given that he didn't sort of play with the band or on recordings or he there are those photographs, but otherwise he should just disappear from history. And it's the testament to him and his impact and his influence.
Yes.
That he still is a crucial part of the development of the band.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's, you know, the story I'm sure anyone listening to this podcast knows is that he stays behind in Hamburg in 61 when the Beatles go back to Liverpool, and he becomes a couple with Astrid, and he dies from a brain hemorrhage a number of months later, very tragically. But as you say, you know, you don't want to romanticize these things, but there is this myth that's come up around Stuart Sutcliffe ever since. And, you know, what might have been, you know, this is now 2020, and obviously Astrid has passed away recently as well. And you got to see what a long tale of influence and impact she had with her work and how she reintegrated with the Beatles, you know, once they became hugely famous.
Yeah, it's this point that we've touched on before, that the story is almost too perfect.
Mm.
You have this cast of characters that come in exactly at the right time.
Mm.
So Astrid is that influence. You know, she is documenting. There can be no other band that has that portfolio of visual material from such an early embryonic stage.
Yes, no one was doing Hasselblad photography of Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. That's true.
No.
But Stuart Sutcliffe is a potential fifth Beatle because the Beatles were five people at the time. We should probably talk about somebody else who was in the five-man Beatles and subsequently the four-man Beatles, which was Pete Best. Pete Best was the original mainstay drummer of the Beatles and played with them in both Liverpool and Hamburg. And Pete Best is almost complete other side of the coin to Stuart Sutcliffe. We've gotten to see how the Pete Best story has unfolded over the last 60 odd years. And, you know, as a late game goal, he's becoming quite entertaining on Twitter in the last 12 or 24 months.
Yes. Yeah.
Does Pete Best get to say, I'm the fifth Beatle?
Well, you know, I think he's as good a claim as Stuart Sutcliffe. He was an official member of the band, he recorded with them. So we have that material available.
Yeah.
So to that extent, there's an audio
record
of what he's done. So I think Pete Best is, it's as a character or as a player, I suppose you also always have to have the slightly sort of tragicomic figure, and there is this notion that whereas Stuart Sutcliffe is a genuinely tragic figure in the story, Pete Best is the sort of unfortunate one.
Yes,
he's the one that just, you know, you get within striking distance of the prize and suddenly it's snatched away, and there's a lot of I suppose lingering ill feeling there.
Yes,
or at least a sense that none of the other four ever wanted to look in that particular corner of the room.
Yeah.
Once it was done, once Pete was gone, they never sort of looked again. I think I've read where Pete is saying since that time, he hasn't spoken to any of them.
Yeah, I find that really strange. Well, I do and I don't. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, you could argue that Pete Best has had to deal with what, you know, John, Paul, Ringo and George were dealing with later on, which is being outside of the Beatles. They just John, Paul, George and Ringo were doing it with millions in the bank, but they basically realized that, you know, the Pete Best wasn't going to get away from it in one way, and none of the others were going to get away from it in a way either.
No, but as you say, they had to some extent, you know, they not only did they have the money and the fame, but they also they had the sort of infrastructure around. They had the organizational sort of support.
They weren't a punchline as well. You do feel that Pete Best gets kind of, you know, he's it's almost an adjective at this point. Oh, you know, he got Pete Bested from the band, you know, or I'm, you know, someone like, off the top of my head, I'm thinking of someone hugely talented like Stephen Tintin Duffy, who was kicked out of Duran Duran just before they became famous. You know, oh, he was the Pete Best of that. It becomes like a...
Yeah.
Pete Best becomes, as you say, it's another one of these things that's part of the story where, you know, Pete Best becomes a thing to be a Pete Best in a situation.
Yeah. It's a trope. It's like, it's always the girlfriend who breaks the band up is Yoko, and
yes,
the one who gets sacked on the cusp of success is a Pete Best.
Yes.
And it must be just have been impossible to deal with.
Yeah.
And to be fair, as you say, recently, he's got quite the social media presence. He's been quite funny. He's entertaining. But I mean, certainly for years, that was a huge issue. If you watch this, is it Snodgrass, the David Quantock?
Oh yeah.
Play where the conceit there is that Lennon left the band.
Yes.
Just before the height of their success, and is constantly haunted by that. So I think you can find that on YouTube, and it 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 you know, he legitimately can say he was in the Beatles. So,
well, he talks about that on, like, first of all, he's involved with the newest Beatles museum in Liverpool at the minute. He runs that with Roag Best, who's his half-brother, whose dad is Neil Aspinall, which is a whole other story, and there's a podcast in that. But yeah, some of the funny things he said on Twitter, because you look back and you look at interviews with him through the years, there's a very interesting interview with him from the mid-80s, and he's on Dave Letterman, and you kind of think, well, actually, there's not much that he has to say except I was kicked out of the Beatles. Like, this, once you get, and even recently he was on an Irish talk show a couple of months back, and once you get past the first couple of minutes, you could argue, well, there isn't an awful lot more to the story, you know?
No, I mean, and he sort of fated to that's his fate. That's the one question.
Yeah.
You know, the questions are always going to be about that one particular period. And, you know, Ringo says he's not interested in writing an autobiography because people only want to know about the sort of 7-8 years that he was with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Pete Best, all they want to know about is literally the 30 minutes he was in the room with Brian Epstein. Well, that becomes the focus of every interview, every question.
And it's interesting, like, so some of the things he said on Twitter recently was, you know, the Beatles official account tweeted out, you know, what got you into the Beatles? And Pete Best said, well, Paul rang me up and said, do you want to get into the Beatles? So that's quite funny. I mean,
it was quite funny. And then the Beatles account retweeted it. So
And that's the only contact. That's the closest he's gotten to getting back to the Beatles. But he does get a 7-figure check around about anthology time because he's finally on a Beatles recording. You could say not only was he a fifth Beatle for a while, he is on a record playing drums on a number of tracks, and that record is by the Beatles.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. But then at the same time, they produce on the album cover.
Oh yes.
That was an unnecessary. So for people that don't know, there's a photograph of the Beatles with the lineup with Pete Best, and they have torn his head off
on the cover of Anthology in that poster look. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, there's a long fallout. There's a huge tail to this, and it is this notion that they never spoke to him again.
Yes.
And he said on a number of occasions, you know, I would like to have that conversation with Paul, and I'd like to have that. I'm sure it's the last thing Paul wants to do, and I'm sure it's not something that Paul wakes up every morning and feels bad about, got rid of Pete. The twist on that, I like to think that Pete has, you know, found his place.
Yes.
Because he released an album last year, 2019, called Heyman's Green.
Yes.
And the cover is the missing piece of the photograph
from
the cover of the Anthology album. And I sort of like to think that was done with a degree of humor and a sort of self-deprecation. And I think, you know, you get a sense that perhaps he is in a good place and has come to terms with everything.
Hopefully so. So Pete Best, potential fifth Beatle. He was there when the Beatles were a 5-piece, but Stuart Sutcliffe left and he was there when the Beatles were a 4-piece. So you could argue he was the fourth Beatle for a while. But also while the Beatles were a 4-piece with Pete Best in Hamburg, a fifth person came along and sang with them. And that was Tony Sheridan.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very tenuous fifth Beatle link for Tony Sheridan.
But you know, they were his backing band.
Yeah.
They made recordings. There are more recordings with Tony Sheridan than with Pete Best.
Yeah, and Stuart Sutcliffe. Yeah, that's true. And so he records. He's playing in Hamburg, and he's playing with various backup bands. And so Lennon, McCartney, Harrison, and Best, they meet him, I think, during their first visit in 1960, and they work with him on their second visit in 61, and it's Bert Kampfert who's the producer.
The producer, yeah. So he saw the Beatles on stage. I think Sheridan was already known in Germany. He was a recording artist there. He put them together, organized a series of a couple of recording sessions, and this is where My Bonnie and the Saints was recorded. And so I think Tony Sheridan and the Beatles, that's a fifth Beatle kind of thing.
It's one of these things that I think, you know, we don't realize that My Bonnie was a bit of a hit. It was a top 10 hit in Germany.
Yeah, in Germany.
In 1962. So, you know, before the Beatles were a thing, almost unbeknown to the Beatles in a way that this was a hit. It didn't really have any impact on them, the fact that My Bonnie was a hit.
No, I mean, the impact is this becomes an import. Someone goes and asks Brian Epstein for it, yeah, and the rest
is history.
Sort of is history. But they're actually credited as the Beat Brothers.
Yes.
On that single. Do you want to explain why they're credited as the Beat Brothers and not the Beatles?
Well, no. Well, it's the word, okay. Beatles is sounds too similar to the German word Beatles, which is a slang term for a part of the body.
Yes,
and you can put two and two together there. So they were called the Beat Brothers.
That's what Google is for.
So yeah, but again, it's another one of these little things that you could say artistically, My Bonnie means nothing, but
yeah,
it is the single that you know is looked for in the NEMS shop that Brian Epstein finds out about the Beatles about. So it does have an important tiny bit. So Tony Sheridan, if he is the fifth Beatle, he brought Brian Epstein and the Beatles together.
Yeah, as you say, it's you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing, but it does just, everything just falls into place.
Yeah.
That you can see the secret. There's a sort of an almost, with hindsight, there seems to be an inevitability about the forward progress of the story, and I think Tony Sheridan is a key part of that.
Okay, so let's then look at, you know, we all know what happens next is that Pete Best gets kicked out, Ringo Starr gets brought in, because after the first EMI session, Pete isn't good enough, and for the second EMI session, the Beatles rock up with Ringo Starr in tow, but George Martin is unaware that this is going to happen, and so when they go in to record Love Me Do, George Martin produces a session drummer, Andy White. And if we're playing the game of, well, if they played with the Beatles on a Beatle record, they're potentially a fifth Beatle, you could say the session drummer, Andy White, he's a fifth Beatle.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ringo, poor Ringo, gets benched.
Yes.
On his very first day. And I think he's quite open about the fact that he never really got over that. I mean, he held it against George Martin.
Indefinitely. Forever. I mean, it's like you look at you look at recent interviews, you look at the anthology, and you know, it really was a genuine one-off. George Martin did not know Ringo was going to turn up, and they had 3 hours to record a single for this band who had no particular experience in recording singles. So I don't blame George Martin, and he never did it again. Like, he just didn't.
No. He didn't. No. But I mean, Ringo does say that he was trying very hard to impress.
Yeah.
So he's drumming. He's, you know, he's got castanets, or he's got maracas in one hand. He's got a tambourine between his teeth. He's kind of, you know, he's going all out and just does not impress. So it's right. That's it. We're going with the original plan. You're on the bench, you know, shake that tambourine and that's it.
That one decision of getting Andy White in to record that first single, I think has this, it's a disastrous little plank or brick in the wall of the notion, the spurious notion that Ringo isn't a good drummer. And I hate it for that. That drives me crazy.
Yeah, that's one of the things. If we demolish any myth on this podcast, it's that notion that Ringo is in any way not a superb drummer, that he's less of a musician than anybody else in the band. That's just simply not the case. But I think you're right. This probably is the trigger for that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he was bumped off the first session, so therefore he must be not a great drummer.
Yeah, but you know, as we say, you know, he makes up for lost time. But Andy White, I wouldn't, you know, when I think of who's the fifth Beatle, I have to admit Andy White doesn't necessarily pop up as top of my list. But I guess if we're being pedantic, we need to.
Yeah, I think it's more interesting from the point of view of just that little thorn in under
Ringo's skin.
Ringo's skin. And we should mention he re-recorded Love Me Do.
Yes, well, he re-recorded it with the Beatles on drums. There is two
with the versions. Beatles. Yeah,
then he did a solo version, didn't he?
He did a solo version in 1998 on the Vertical Man album, and I'm here to tell you it's not great.
You heard it here first, you know, folks. But sticking with drums, then there is, you know, and this notion of people who have played with the Beatles, we have the fascinating character of Jimmy Nicol. And I find the story of Jimmy Nicol, again, it's another one of these stories in the Beatle universe, which is, almost like a warning, you know?
Yeah.
For people who don't know Jimmy Nickle, what's the tale of Jimmy Nickle?
Jimmy Nickle, briefly put, stood in for Ringo on the first eight shows of the 1964 World Tour while Ringo was languishing in hospital with tonsillitis. So this came up, Ringo's illness occurred, and they had to make a decision. Do they cancel the tour? Do they postpone the tour? Do they get somebody else in?
Yeah.
And, you know, legend would have it that the person who was against getting a replacement is George Harrison. Everyone else is saying, no, we'll get someone else in. You know, it'll be temporary. First few shows, once Ringo's well, he can join us. That's perfectly fine. So again, it's difficult to see if it had been the following year.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think they would just have cancelled the tour, they would have postponed the tour.
Yeah, but in 1964, you could argue that, you know, again, they are accelerating into an international phenomenon that nobody's really had to deal with before. You know, you don't even know whether there's going to be a Beatles in 1965, and
this is it. It's short term. Yeah. No one knows is this going to last or is it not going to last?
And you know, it's what's fascinating, and this is referenced in Craig Rounds' recent book 1, 2, 3, 4. When you see pictures of John, Paul, George, and Jimmy. It just jars.
Yes, it's not right.
It's so not right, and it's really striking. He plays these eight gigs, and he's apparently not even the first choice. The names that stand here are Ray Duvall, which is good, and a guy called Bobby Graham, a session man. And depending on how you read the story, either it's Epstein or Paul McCartney or both, who kind of Jimmy Nickle kind of comes into their universe via. Georgie Fame, I think, is it?
Georgie Fame, yeah. So at this point in his career, Jimmy Nickle is playing with Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames.
Yeah.
And supposedly it's Paul on one version calls Georgie Fame and says, you know, will you lend us your drummer?
Yeah.
So he comes down to the studio and he rehearses six songs with the band in the studio.
Yeah.
And they didn't record it. And you think that, you know, that would be an interesting little kind of aside,
yes,
to have a six song session with them teaching Jimmy how to play like Ringo.
And and he gets given a signing on fee of £2,500, and he gets paid £2,500 per gig, and it's 27 hours or so.
Yep.
Legend goes from getting the phone call to being on stage in Copenhagen playing with the Beatles.
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
And crazy money.
Yeah.
That, you know, absolutely crazy money. So
and it's odd.
13 days.
You do wonder, is it another chink in the armor of Ringo was replaceable? You know, it's
yeah.
And you kind of feel sorry for Ringo. I mean, I can't imagine what he must have thought. He you know, it's when you look at the early days of the Beatles, you know, when Ringo just gets in, he's still finding his feet, and now they're top of the world on their first ever tour, and he's not there.
What I would say is he must have been thinking these guys have got form.
Well, yeah, like they got
They got rid of Pete.
They got rid of Pete to go up one set of stairs, and now they're going up another set of stairs, and they could just get rid of me.
Yeah. So if it had been this huge success, and you know, the fans had been screaming for Jimmy Nickle, he must have been thinking, he was the last one in.
Yeah, and it's but what is very striking is, you know, there is. You know, press conference footage and news footage of Jimmy with the other three. And obviously he seems to be intimidated, but he's, I don't mean to be nasty, but he's a bit of a charisma vacuum, you know,
it's indicative of just how tight they were as a band. You know, you look at the press conferences that they give, particularly those sort of American airport press conferences. Ringo is a key player, and everyone thinks, you know, John is the sort of snappy, fast, you know, quick-witted one. Ringo more than holds his own.
Absolutely.
There, and Jimmy Nickle just is parachuted in, and he is like a rabbit in headlights.
Well, Ringo also, I think, has a really important role in the Beatles. He's almost an audience within the band. That, you know, he knows what the band are before he's in the band. And when he's in the band, he's watching the other three guys all the time, and he's laughing at them. He's always, even to this day, he's entertained by the other Beatles. He was the, and you know, we talked in our Ringo episode that he's this kind of glue that the others will come towards. He loves being a fan of the band in a way, and he's kind of the internal audience within the four of them.
He is, yeah. I mean, they all from time to time will talk about the Beatles as being something apart.
Yes.
From them as individuals, you know, Beatle George or Beatle Paul. But Ringo frequently does that. And, you know, free as a bird, he's listening to, and he said, yeah, it sounds just like them. It sounds just like the Beatle. So yes, that hadn't occurred to me before, but yeah, he's like the little traveling audience that they bring with him, but he participates as well. And his contribution to those press conferences and the sort of the humor and that whole early sort of character of the band is absolutely great. And you take him out, you drop Jimmy Nicol in, and it's not
it's
the
just
same.
Not right, but it does give you an insight that it wouldn't have been right with Pete Best either. And Jimmy Nicol, he plays the Beatles in Copenhagen. He travels across the world, and he's, in fairness to them, they do. It's not like the three of them are doing interviews without Jimmy Nicol. It's like the four of them.
No.
They do 13 days. And they go across the Netherlands, Hong Kong, they go off to Australia, and Ringo rejoins them in Melbourne, and they're all delighted to see him. And Jimmy Nicol is turfed. He's just like, okay, they give him a watch, if memory serves, and they send him back to the airport. And there is this shocking photo of Jimmy Nicol sitting on his own in the airport as if to say, what has just happened?
Yeah. It's that is people should find that photograph. It's incredibly striking, where it's just this man sitting on his own, slightly shell shocked look, as you say, just what have I been through? And you know, he must be then thinking, I was in the Beatles. Yeah. This is a big thing. I can capitalize on this. I can capitalize on the connection.
It does go to his head, though. He just falls apart after all that, doesn't he? He comes back to the UK, and you know, he's bankrupt a year later.
Yeah. So he thinks he's going to have a success. He forms a band. There's no real success. No one's interested. And again, that must be an incredible shock to go from having tens of thousands of people, you know, outside your hotel, to literally no one cares. Yeah. And as you say, it's a sort of salutary tale. It's a warning. You get too close to this, it's going to change your life, and not necessarily in a good way.
And the legend is he inspired the song "Getting Better." That was a Jimmy Nicolism, if there is such a thing.
Yeah. So Paul would say to him, you know, well, how's it going? And he would say, oh, it's getting better. and in the Hunter Davies biography, Hunter Davies recalls Paul recalling this. The next thing, this becomes a trigger for a song.
He becomes a bit of a mystery man, though, doesn't he? Is he alive? Is he dead? Where is he?
Yeah,
what's he doing?
There's a book... For those of you who want to read more about it, there's a book called The Beatle Who Vanished by a chap called Jim Birkenstadt. It was published in 2013, which is a sort of detailed... I get that. I read the book. It was very interesting. It was a fascinating story, but I did feel slightly voyeuristic. There's a slightly stalkerish quality about this book, where they're trying to hunt him down. But there are Beatles connections everywhere. So he turns up at a Dutch Beatles convention in 1984, and in 1994 his son says, you know, he's died, he's passed away. Mark Lewisohn,
yes,
however, records the fact that he met him in 1995. His son was a sound recordist on the Anthology project.
You can't make it up. It's amazing.
You know, he got a BAFTA for that.
And
the rumor is,
but he's paparazzi then in the 21st century, isn't he?
Yes, he is. The Daily Mail track him down in 2005 to a flat. And there's just something unpleasant about the fact that they're just stalking this guy. The one little anecdote I want to reference is that John makes reference to him in the Let It Be.
What does he say?
So he said, where they're talking about, they're maybe going to go play a concert somewhere. They're going to go to Tunisia. They're going to go to North Africa. And John says, I think you'll find we're not going abroad because Ringo just said he doesn't want to go abroad. You know, he put his foot down. Although Jimmy Nicol might go abroad. So they're still...
still a punchline.
Yeah, he's still a punchline.
So we're still... I still don't think we've untied this knot of who was the fifth Beatle. But if we're moving on to, you know, people who played with the Beatles, well, there's two further names I can think of when you think of, well, who played with John, Paul, George and Ringo. And the first one that might come up is Eric Clapton, who...
Yeah.
He plays the solo on Why My Guitar Gently Weeps on the White Album. And that wasn't really particularly known at the time. He certainly doesn't get a credit on the sleeve.
No, he doesn't get a credit. I think in those days, the contractual arrangements were such that if musicians are playing on each other's records at the time, they just can't be credited because of label issues or contractual issues. The story there is George brings him in order to, because he can't get the guitar solo. He doesn't feel he can get something right. Plus, it's a slightly fractious atmosphere in the studio around the White Album. And it's this notion that you bring somebody in from outside, everybody behaves a little better. Everybody ups their game. You bring Eric Clapton in. Everybody's going to up their game.
Well, it is that thing that's happening at that time, 68, 69, particularly Clapton is in and out of different bands. You know, there's Cream and Blind Faith, and there's this notion of, you know, there's a coterie of people who could be used. And you mightn't think of Eric Clapton as being a fifth Beatle, but, you know, as I said, it's kind of in the ether that people are moving around in and out of different bands. And then in January 69, when Harrison walks out of the Get Back, Let It Be sessions, Lennon suggests, so we'll just get Eric Clapton in. Like, that's the most normal thing in the world.
Yeah. Yes, and it is the start. I think you're absolutely right. It is the start of that sort of journeyman or sort of jobbing musician. Mm. You know, even amongst the rock royalty, you know, we've always had session musicians and that people perform, but suddenly, you know, you can get Eric Clapton to play on a Beatles record, or you can get Ry Cooder will come and play on a Stones record, or George can get everybody to come and play on All Things Must Pass. And there's a sort of a rock aristocracy that starts to circulate, move around playing on each other's projects in the late 60s. And this is probably one of the first really high profile ones.
And well, Eric Clapton is probably, you know, he's probably a standard of that. I mean, he goes on, I think he appears on every Beatles solo record in some form at some point in the future, doesn't he? He's done Cold Turkey, and he's obviously does lots of work with George. He becomes this person who just becomes an
expert. He's part of that that group of people. I mean, I say it's almost like a rock aristocracy that all date from that particular era. He supposedly was not particularly happy with the solo.
Really?
So he records the solo. And then, you know, it's fine. But then George says, okay, we're going to make it a little bit Beatly. And they put that
effect on it, yes.
That effect on it. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't sound, if you listen to what he's doing at that time with Cream, it doesn't sound like Eric Clapton. He has a very distinctive tone. Not to everybody's taste, but they treat this in a way that makes it, you know, the Beatles have to do something different.
Well, I remember, you know, buying the Beatles complete kind of sheet music book in the 80s, and it's kind of got an introductory foreword about the band, and one of the things it singles out is George Harrison's fantastic guitar solo on While My Guitar Gently Weeps. So even
excellent.
And I think that was originally written in the late 70s, so it's it wasn't a bit of common knowledge at that time. But cut from the same cloth as Eric Clapton coming into While My Guitar Gently Weeps, we get to someone who, from a musician's point of view, really probably has total claim to being a fifth Beatle, and that's Billy Preston. Billy Preston brought in, like Eric Clapton, to try and change people's attitudes, up their game, relieve tension, and ends up in a totally unique position of getting a credit on a record, The Beatles with Billy Preston. So that is...
Yeah.
That's almost, you could argue, that's as fifth Beatle as it gets.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a pub quiz question is, you know, who are the two non-members to receive billing on a Beatles record? And it's Billy Preston and Tony Sheridan.
Yeah, bookending their whole career, really.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, he was brought in. He had met the Beatles when he was touring with part of Little Richard's band back in 1962 in Hamburg. Yeah. He meets them again in 1969. George is at a Ray Charles concert. He's playing the organ in Ray Charles's band, and George says, "Hey, you know, come back." And certainly, if you look at him, I've never seen a picture of Billy Preston where he doesn't have a grin on his face. I mean, he just seems to be very easygoing, yes. Very enthusiastic. The story is that John Lennon was on the spot ready to make him a full member of the band, and Paul is kind of going, "Whoa, now hang on a minute," you know. So
classic
he,
Paul.
He came within a hair's breadth, shall we say, of actually becoming a fully signed up.
I mean, it's a wonderful thing that Billy Preston gets involved with the Beatles, because it's certainly not an obvious pairing that you would pull someone from that, you know, the touring world or the musician's world of being in Little Richard band, playing with Little Richard or playing with Ray Charles, and then dropping him into the Beatles. It's one of those Beatles serendipity things.
Yeah, and it's that sort of coincidence of seeing them right at the start of their career, and then he's on the rooftop playing them out at the end of their career. And of course he plays on Abbey Road on a couple of tracks. He is signed to the Apple label. He works very closely with George Harrison, who produces the two albums that he made. There's hit singles. He records a version of My Sweet Lord, All Things Must Pass. So he's right at the center of that whole Apple organization.
Yeah, and so from a fifth Beatle point of view, you think, well, there's a five-person group. You know, there's John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Billy. He's playing the role as a fifth Beatle. And yeah, it's interesting in the recent Abbey Road box set to hear him let loose, you know, on I Want You, She's So Heavy.
That is a revelation, because that is mixed on the finished article, that is mixed so low in the mix that you're aware that it's there, but you can't really appreciate what it is that he's contributing or what he's doing.
And it does give you an idea of, well, actually, if he was a fifth Beatle, like if, say, in some parallel universe where they went off to tour Abbey Road, of course he'd have been in the band. And you know, he kind of, you know, you could argue there's something about the Get Back, Let It Be sessions that has a certain kind of sound or vibe. But when you hear him in sort of the Abbey Road, you know, sessions, you know, it's a different type of thing. It's a different type of studio performance. And you're like, oh, actually, this guy really works fantastically well here.
Yes, he does. He fits. He absolutely fits right in. And he went on to work with Ringo, with George, with John. He's across their sort of early 70s solo work.
And they're all back together again at the concert for George, aren't they?
They're all at the concert for George. So at one point on the stage, you have Paul, Ringo, Eric Clapton, Billy Preston, Danny Harrison.
Yeah. And you don't like to talk about going to that gig, so
I don't like to mention that. The other thing about Billy Preston is, not only is he the fifth Beatle, he is the sixth Stone.
Oh yeah, go on then. Where does he fit in the Stones lineage then?
Well, he worked extensively with Stones live and in the studio between 1971 and 1977.
Right.
So if you look at those, the Stones have a reissue program, and particularly 1975, he plays on the Black and Blue album, and there's a song on that called Melody. He basically, it's a duet between Billy Preston and Mick Jagger. It's credited as a Jagger Richard song, but I once, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I saw Bill Wyman's Rhythm Kings, and they played that song, and Bill Wyman very pointedly said, "This is a song that was written by Billy Preston."
Wow! Wow!
He played with the Beatles, he played with the Stones. I also saw him on stage touring as part of Eric Clapton's band.
So that's an interesting list of people we've just rattled through there. Musicians who have all, in some form or another, played as a fifth person to the Beatles that you could argue. So were they fifth Beatles? Is there a particular winner there? I'm not sure. But we're going to make a small segue, because the two people who generally get tagged as being fifth Beatles are Brian Epstein and George Martin. Now, we think both Brian and George could have podcast episodes of their own, and they will happen in due course. But I think you cannot talk about the notion of a fifth Beatle without talking about Brian Epstein and George Martin. And I think when push comes to shove, putting aside the notion of, you know, this notion, oh, well, they played with the Beatles, they're a fifth Beatle. You know, Brian and George Martin are the number one heavyweight contenders for the fifth Beatle question, aren't they?
I think so. And, you know, again, back to the pub question, if you ask the man on the street, I would think George Martin is probably the one that would spring to mind, certainly in terms of creative input. And, you know, we've been talking about musicians. You know, George Martin plays on numerous Beatles sessions, right from the very first album all the way through. So his actual musical contribution is pretty consistent, plus the arranging, the producing, the arranging. Yes. So I think it's hard to sort of get past that George Martin as being...
I think you're right. I mean, actually, you know, yeah, we have it on... You know, we have quotes from Paul McCartney saying, if anyone was the fifth Beatle, it was Brian Epstein. And we also have Paul McCartney quoted as saying, if anyone earned the title of fifth Beatle, it was George Martin. So even Paul...
Paul can't make his mind
up. But yeah, I think certainly, you know, Brian Epstein, he was a key fifth Beatle in terms of nailing down what their approach was to show business, in nailing down their attitude, their, you know, marshalling their work ethic to getting them to play around the clubs, getting them a recording contract. But the key part of Brian Epstein's work as a fifth Beatle is making that connection to George Martin. And if we're sitting here 50 plus 60 years later, the reason those records sound like Beatle records is because of George Martin. That's just it, really. And that's probably, as you say, the most important thing.
I think so. If you listen to their contemporaries, particularly in the early 60s up to sort of 67 or maybe 68, I'm thinking here of The Who and The Kinks and The Stones, the records sound different. You know, they are very much artifacts of the 60s. The Beatles have a sound, and whether that's the studio or George Martin, but they just sound different to their contemporaries. They're more polished, and they have a modern sound. They don't sound dated in the way that, you know, I mean, I bow to no one in my respect for Ray Davies as a songwriter and the Kinks as a band, but there's a very thin production sound to a lot of what those singles. You know, I think George Martin is absolutely crucial. And as you say, we touched on this earlier, it's the sort of, with hindsight, the inevitability, the forward progress of the story. So you've got Brian Epstein coming in off the back of the Tony Sheridan single, and then he is the link to George Martin. Epstein, one of the things that we have talked about before is this idea that the Beatles sort of outgrow showbiz.
Yes.
You know, so when Epstein takes them on, his main drive is to get them out of the cavern, get them into bigger venues, get them more money, get them looking more professional. And clearly at that point, I think he can have no other idea in his head than the traditional showbiz model. So he comes from a theatrical background. He's, you know, and they're touring cinemas, they're touring theaters, they're touring small venues. Then suddenly he has done his job, and then suddenly it just gets to America, and the next thing they're in Shea Stadium and they're playing in front of tens of thousands of people. And it's, you know, for all that Brian Epstein gets criticized about the sort of commercial deals and his lack of business sense and what have you, there was no roadmap, and he is taking them to places where there's no road.
Well, effectively. And I think you're right. And I think Brian Epstein, you know, he was the best manager for the Beatles. He loved them dearly. He was very clear and honest with them. But when you look at the whole arc of the story, you know, his death was a a huge tragedy and changed the whole Beatles story. But you rewind back a little bit more and you start looking at 66 and 67, you know, Brian is moving away, he's letting go. Whereas in 66, 67, when the Beatles are ready to ramp up to the next gear, George Martin is like, you want to do Revolver? Okay. You want to do Pepper? Okay. I'm here to do it, you know? And even as early as 64, you know, the Beatles are saying in interviews, you know, we can't praise George Martin too highly. He's bubbling over with ideas. He's one of us. He doesn't act like a schoolmaster in the studio. They have a great relationship. And if you think of hours of creativity that they spend with George Martin, you know, he's probably the person they spend the most time with in the 60s when they're in their creative Beatle mode. More time with him being creative than certainly with Brian overall, or certainly they're never really creative with Brian in that way.
Exactly. I mean, I think again, as one chapter ends, as the touring ends, and they move it to being a studio band, Epstein's role is receding, and he's sort of almost passing a baton over.
Yeah.
And I mean, there is the story there where he around that period he's commenting from the control booth in the studio, make some comments about the music, and Lennon cuts him down by saying, you know, you do what you do and we'll do what
well speaking we do. Of Lennon, you know, I think Lennon would really despise us having this conversation about Fifth Beatles. You know, he's, you know, we've got quotes from him talking to Ian Wenner and all that kind of stuff where he says, you know, Dick James is one of these people who think they made us, they didn't. I'd like to hear Dick James's music. I'd like to hear George Martin's music. And he writes in a letter, Lennon writes in a letter to Paul at some point, you know, when people ask questions about what did George Martin do for you, I have one answer. What did he do now? He's, you know, it's the truth. I'm not putting him down. You know, Lennon doesn't like this notion of scrutiny.
Well, you know, the answer to that is, if you where is George Martin's music? Well, it's all over the second side of the Yellow Submarine soundtrack.
It's actually very good.
It's very good. And what was he doing in the early 70s? Well, he was having huge hits with America.
He was,
And producing, going on to produce Jeff Beck. And
well, maybe another good John quote is, I'm not the Beatles, I'm me. Paul isn't the Beatles, Brian Epstein wasn't the Beatles, neither is Dick James. The Beatles are the Beatles. And maybe there aren't really any Fifth Beatles. But
well, to be fair, I think John sort of, as he was wont to do, rolled back on a lot of those criticisms.
He did, and
you know, but he said he helped George Martin helped us develop the language that allowed us to speak to other musicians. So it's you know, all of the Beatles went on, maybe not so much Ringo, but I think Ringo has a couple of production credits on his own records. But you know, they developed their production techniques.
Yes.
From George Martin. I mean, and there's a very distinctive style, and particularly George in the stuff that he is doing for the Apple label. So he's not only influencing their music, but he's influencing their production style, and they take that into their solo career.
So I think we're going to say George Martin is the closest thing to a Fifth Beatle, if you have to do such petty ranking. If it's important to you, let's just say that George Martin really doesn't hold a candle to a lot of other people on our list in terms of being there and contributing and making the Beatles the thing that we are still talking about today.
I think so. I think that's a fair comment. Yeah, we answered the question.
So maybe we did get to the bottom of this. But look, we in the future, I think we will revisit the life and times of Brian Epstein, the life and times of George Martin. And there is a larger question at stake. Who is the sixth Beatle, the seventh Beatle, the eighth Beatle? You can make a top 100 bunch of people who have influenced the Beatles in some ways. You know, where does Bob Dylan sit on that list? Where does the...
I can see where you're going.
Where does the dentist who gave them LSD live on that list? All of these people are somewhere in that ranking of Beatles. And, you know, ranking and making lists is what most podcasts are all about anyway, isn't it?
it's what we do.
But what do you think, everybody? Do you have a notion of who was the fifth Beatle? Doesn't matter. Maybe we're all Beatles. Let us know what you think. We are, as usual, available in the normal places. Twitter at BeatlesPod is our handle there. Join us and follow us there. We'll tweet you about episodes and what we're doing and any kind of interesting Beatle information that we can pass your way. There's a a private Facebook group. Just search for the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, or there's a link for it in our Twitter handle as well. And Stephen is in control of that, and he'll let you in. We hope you continue to subscribe and download. If you're enjoying us, please leave a kind review wherever you like to get your podcasts. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.